was capable of magnifying a microdot more than 30 times. TSS bought 100 Stanhope lenses in the early 1950s from a novelty company, only to discover that they came preloaded with sexy pinup photos of American starlets. The potentially offensive images were removed before the viewer was issued to agents, and the lens required no further modification. The tiny size of the bullet lens enabled it to be readily concealed and transported inside a cigarette or bottle of ink, or sewn into the seam of a jacket or dress. One case officer carried the lens in the corner of his eye. Operationally, the bullet lens was so small that the care and skill required to position the dot and view the message made it unpopular with agents. Despite its deficiencies, the bullet lens proved invaluable for some operations. In 1969, the CIA recruited a middle-class Cantonese-speaking woman to serve as a courier into southern China. The courier, who lived in Hong Kong, had immediate family members living in Canton, whom she partially supported by her modest jade and semi-precious stone shop. Among her family members was a first cousin, also a CIA asset, with connections to a pro-democracy intellectual group that produced anti-government publications and leaflets. The CIA was supporting the effort as a covert action and used microdots embedded in personal letters and postcards as the primary means of covert communication. When the agent lost the last of his microdot readers, the COVCOM link collapsed. The case officer appealed to the courier to take several new bullet lens readers, each approximately the size of a grain of rice, to her cousin. Recognizing that border checks for anyone entering China were intense, with pat-downs and body cavity searches common, the case officer suggested the lens be embedded into the gauze of a Band-Aid that covered an active sore on the courier's foot. The proposal was met with scorn. From the agent's perspective, the concealment was far too dangerous because the hard lens might be felt through the gauze. If discovered, the penalty would be severe. The agent agreed to take one of the lenses, but said she would think of a much better concealment by their next meeting. A week later, as the two were meeting, the agent unexpectedly dumped on the table a catty, 680 grams, of dried fish, each fish about the size of a small minnow. The tabletop was covered with dozens of little fish. "Find it," she ordered the case officer. "What?" he replied. "The lens is with the fish. You find it." Her tone was not amused. The case officer looked at the fish. All were the same, dried, and some nearly translucent. He picked up several and examined. There was no way he could even imagine where the lens might be. "I can't." The agent began picking up fish and rubbing each between her fingers. After handling several, she announced, "Here it is." She peeled off the dry skin and tore open the fish. Out popped the lens. The lens had been inserted through the mouth into the belly of the fish. The expandable cavity was long and large enough to hold the lens, but the lens itself was not so thick as to distort the fish's appearance. "This will be a lot safer than your Band-Aid. They will never inspect these fish, which are like what everyone takes into China," the courier asserted. The case officer could only agree and thought of lyrics from the musical The King and I. "When you become a teacher, by your students you'll be taught." In this instance, however, when you become a case officer, by your asset you will be taught. The operation was successful, and the lens reached the agent as planned. TSD produced a more user-friendly microdot viewer, the 114 reader, that was about the size of two pencil erasers. It unscrewed so that the dot could be placed between the two halves and viewed. The superior optics and larger size of the viewer made it more popular with agents, but also more difficult to conceal. The largest of the CIA's microdot viewers was the Little Telescope, about the size of an unfiltered cigarette, with an internal telescoping section for magnification up to 150 times. The viewer was more powerful and easier for agents to use than its predecessors, but it was much larger. If detected, it was clearly recognizable as a piece of spy gear, but the little telescope was still small enough to be concealed in a pack of cigarettes or a modified fountain pen. In 1983, the CIA recruited Soviet Colonel Vladimir Mikhailovich Vasiliev in Budapest and assigned the code name GT Accord. To communicate with him after his return to Moscow, OTS perfected a new technique of sending messages using a Hewlett-Packard computerized laser engraver. The technique allowed the CIA to etch a microscopic message into the black borders of features inside the February 1983 issue of National Geographic magazine. The hidden message in the ruled line was invisible to the unaided eye, though readable with a 30x magnifier. The laser engraver burned away microns of ink to leave a message that had characteristics of a microdot, but did not require the additional stages of development and precise handling. By etching the message on an advertisement in a popular magazine to which GT Accord had normal access, there was no link back to a specific agent should the presence of the message be detected. The secret message contained the internal COMO plan for GT Accord to contact CIA. It read, "Your package should always be in a waterproof wrapper placed inside a dirty, oily rag tied with string." The COMO plan worked. Colonel Vasiliev spied for the United States for 3 years until he was betrayed by CIA officers Edward Lee Howard and Aldrich Ames in 1984 and 1985. Vasiliev was arrested in 1986 and executed in 1987. One laser engraving effort left an enduring olfactory memory with the OTS techs. In this operation, the covert message was placed on a borderline of an advertisement for fancy chocolates in a gourmet magazine. The advertisement was printed with newly developed chocolate-scented ink, and when the laser engraver began burning the ink to embed the message, the entire OTS lab took on the smell of fresh-baked chocolate chip cookies. Another reduced image technique involved photography that used a sensitive, fragile emulsion layer of film. This plastic wrap-like substance could be separated from the thicker cellulose base of some types of film. Called soft film by the KGB, it was one of the most usable methods for clandestine communication even before World War II, and saw use extensively throughout the Cold War. Typically, a frame of soft film contained the image of a single page of text, which could be produced in a variety of sizes. Although a frame was much larger than a microdot and more vulnerable to detection, it was much easier for the agent to use. Larger examples could be disguised as photoprotectors inside a man's wallet or the shiny coating of a postcard, such as was used by George Sachs's agent in the late 1960s. Pieces of the pliable film could be rolled into tiny cylinders as small as the size of a matchstick, concealed in such varied household items as a hollow pencil or a ballpoint pen refill, or sewn into the lining of clothing, and then read using a standard magnifying glass. Calvar, a commercial product developed as an alternative to traditional microfilm, represented one of the OTS's most successful special films for reduced image photography. The company that first manufactured it ceased operations in 1979, but other firms continued to make Calvar for OTS. In operational use, the advantage of Calvar was that it could be handled and processed in normal room light, did not require special chemicals, and was developed in boiling water. Ultra-thin base, UTB, films were used for the sub-miniature cameras provided to agents and officers for clandestine photography. The thinner backing, base, allowed a standard film cassette to contain hundreds of exposures and increased the volume of information passed in a dead drop exchange. UTB film could not withstand the rigors of passing through automated processing and developing equipment, however, and required OTS techs to hand roll, spool, and later process the exposed film at remote field photo labs. The combination of UTB film and reliable OTS subminiature cameras produced some of the CIA's best Cold War intelligence. For further enhancement of operational security for clandestine photography, TSD developed special processing film, SPR, that looked and performed exactly like a standard cassette of 35mm film. However, after the film was exposed, any attempt to develop the images by a person without knowledge of the counterintuitive steps required would result in a completely black or transparent strip on any part of the film that was SPR treated. The advantage of SPR film was that the agent could photograph secret documents and keep the film in his camera with the knowledge that even if it should be searched and the film processed, the compromising evidence on the roll would not be discovered. During operational meetings, both the agent and handler would make and retain written notes for reminders, specific instructions, phone numbers, and names. Because the notes were sensitive and potentially compromising, a means to destroy the notes quickly and thoroughly, if necessary, was required. OTS developed a variety of secure note-taking capabilities for protecting such information. Water-soluble paper was produced by a small CIA-owned papermaking machine and cut and bound into forms required by operations. Visually, the special paper resembled thin copy or tracing paper, although it could also be made in a variety of weights. When dropped in water or any other liquid, the paper, together with the ink or pencil markings, dissolved immediately. Splashing water on the soluble paper left an instant gooey remainder that could not be restored to recover the original writing. The CIA agent Reisard Kuklinski had a pad of water-soluble paper onto which he copied his exfiltration plan to study and memorize. The original plan was passed to Kuklinski on a microfilm that he kept hidden. However, by copying the plan on water-soluble paper and taping it beneath his kitchen cabinet, it was more readily accessible, and Kuklinski felt confident he could destroy the information quickly, if necessary, by dropping it into a waiting pan of water in the kitchen sink. A case officer driving through a city to identify new dead drop and signal sites would need a way to make notes, but also required a quick destruction method if stopped by local police or involved in an automobile accident. Water-soluble paper and a handy bottle of water provided the solution. If a problem arose, the water could be doused on the notes, reducing them to a mushy residue. An alternative was flash paper, a form of nitrocellulose that burned quickly and completely with a bright flame without smoke or ash. Any printing or writing on the paper would be destroyed when ignited. Because agents and case officers often smoked, a lit cigarette could be used to ignite flash paper carrying operational notes, one-time pads, communications plans, and other sensitive material. The effectiveness of instant destruction was offset by the reality that the flash of the ignited flash paper would assuredly attract attention, limiting its operational use. Another option available to case officers was the so-called more or less invisible, MLI, writing instruments developed by the chemists in OTS's secret writing program. The abundance of ballpoint pens and other plastic products in the 1960s led the scientists to coat commonly available plastic items with special chemicals. The treated items, when used as a writing instrument, left invisible traces of the chemical residue on paper that could subsequently be developed and read. While a casual observer would see nothing on the paper, professional techniques could detect the presence of secret writing. Only imagination limited the variety of plastic that could be used. MLI chemistry could be applied to eyeglass frames, caps on ballpoint pens, plastic key fobs, credit cards, and even the plastic toothpick on commercial models of the Swiss Army knife. Case officers using an MLI device to write invisibly on a piece of paper could carry those safely until returning to the station, where a tech developed the notes. TSD answered a request from the Directorate of Operations in the early 1970s to provide a secure system that would allow a case officer or tech to record and store operational notes on a tape recorder. OTS modified small commercial Sony stereo tape recorders by adding an additional or third track recording head. In use, the tape recorder would function normally to play tapes filled with local music in two channels of stereo. When an officer wanted to record operational notes, he activated a switch OTS had built into the recorder and turned on the secret recording head for the third track. The audio would be recorded on the tape, but on a track that was unreadable by any non-modified tape recorder, and only an operational listener would know how to activate the switch to listen to the third track. In a variation on the concept, the clandestine communication branch of MI6 created a similar covert system. Former MI6 officer Richard Tomlinson described it. The essential feature of these gadgets is that they are non-compromising, i.e., they are identical or virtually indistinguishable from commercially available equipment. Pedal recorders were particularly ingenious. Any normal audio cassette has two tracks running parallel to each other, one for each side of the cassette. Pedal recorders exploit the unused part of the magnetic tape, which lies between the two strips. We observed an ordinary personal stereo, which played and recorded on both sides of the tape like an ordinary machine. But turning it upside down tripped a micro switch, so that pressing the stop and record buttons together made the machine record over the central track, while pressing stop and play together made it play back the recording. Codes and ciphers play essential roles in successful covert communication systems. A code obscures the meaning of a message of any kind by substituting words, numbers, or symbols for plain text, the unencrypted text of the message. A single symbol could represent an idea or an entire message. The signals made with chalk, lipstick, or a thumbtack to initiate a dead drop sequence were examples of codes, while the message concealed inside the dead drop had the added protection of a cipher. A cipher represented a particular type of code in which numbers and letters were systematically substituted according to a prearranged plan. Ciphers used a key to convert the plain text message. Probably no piece of spy gear was more often issued or more reliable than the one-time pad. OTPs, the only cipher system that was known to be theoretically unbreakable, were composed of one or more pages filled with random numbers arranged in groups of five. Only two copies of an OTP were produced, one copy for the agent and one for the handler. To maintain the security of communications, the OTP page and all notes from using it were to be destroyed by the agent as soon as the working session was completed. OTPs had great advantages and were praised by both agents and handlers. One OTS tech who ran operations in Moscow for 2 decades stated, "OTPs didn't let us down. They didn't leave you or the agent wondering if the communication was secure." OTPs proved to be the best COVCOM security available during most of the Cold War. Agents had immense confidence in the security of the OTP system because they understood that even if the message was discovered, its contents would be illegible and there was no link to the agent. The difficulty with the system was that OTPs were immediately recognized as spy gear if discovered, and since only used once, they had to be constantly resupplied through dead drops. The one-way voice link described a covert communication system that transmitted messages to an agent's unmodified shortwave radio using the high-frequency shortwave bands between 3 and 30 megahertz at a predetermined time, date, and frequency contained in their communications plan. The transmissions were contained in a series of repeated random number sequences and could only be deciphered using the agent's one-time pad. If proper tradecraft was practiced and instructions were precisely followed, an OWVL transmission was considered unbreakable. The agent was able to use OWVL only to receive communications, but it had many advantages over secret writing or agent meetings. OWVL required no spy gear except a one-time pad, was generally reliable and repeatable, and precluded surveillance. As long as the agent's cover could justify possessing a shortwave radio and who is not under technical surveillance, high-frequency OWVL was a secure and preferred system for the CIA during the Cold War. The OWVL transmission consisted of a series of numbers, usually in groups of 4 or 5. During the 1950s and 1960s, they were read by a man or woman, and in later years produced by an electronically generated voice. The numbers could be spoken in any language, usually timed to begin on the hour, quarter hour, or half hour, and were repeated hours or days later on the same or a different frequency. Facilities with giant antenna farms to broadcast OWVL signals to every country of operational interest were positioned at strategic locations in the United States and abroad. The site served the dual purpose of handling CIA staff communications traffic as well as messages for agents. In the late 1970s, OTS and the Office of Communications began upgrading the OWVL system with the development of the Interim One-Way Link, IOWL. This used the same broadcast stations and network as OWVL, but the agent's commercial shortwave radio was replaced by a dedicated IOWL receiver. The self-contained miniature piece of spy gear was a black box about the size of a pack of cigarettes and half as deep, including the internal battery. Its size made concealment relatively easy, and it could be plugged into a standard speaker or operated with headphones. The primary benefit to the agent was the speed of receiving a message. The numbers were transmitted at higher speeds and then stored internally in the receiver to be recalled later. Decreasing the time an agent had to spend performing the covert activity of listening to and transcribing shortwave transmissions improved security and his efficiency. Messages that previously had required the agent to listen and copy for an hour could be received in 10 minutes. IOWL required the agent to possess and hide another piece of spy gear, but because it was technically equal to OWVL and offered advances in reception speed and an improvement in weak signal reception, the system was widely deployed. Short-range agent communications, known as SHRAC systems, represented a technological revolution for COVCOM when OTS deployed the first units to agents inside the Soviet Union in the mid-1970s. SHRAC enabled the agent and case officer to exchange information without being required to come into close proximity or conduct a clandestine act, such as loading a drop, that might be observed. It also eliminated the risk of leaving sensitive material unattended in a dead drop, which might be discovered and traced back to the agent. The original SHRAC systems exchanged short-duration, encrypted radio frequency messages of a few hundred characters in less than 5 seconds between two black box transceivers. An agent carried a pocket-sized SHRAC unit in his coat and shot his message at designated locations at any time, day or night. He did not need to know or be concerned about the location of the SHRAC receiver, which could have been located in an embassy, a residence, or in the handbag of a lady standing in front of a department store. SHRAC defeated physical surveillance by eliminating the requirement for agent and case officer ever to be in the same location. It was, however, potentially vulnerable to signal interception if an opposition service was monitoring the SHRAC frequency at the time and in the area of a transmission. Because SHRAC could be initiated by the agent, the CIA then had a reliable capability to receive time-sensitive reporting and could immediately retask the agent with follow-up requirements. When military tensions between Greece and Turkey were at the flashpoint during the 1990s, senior CIA officers credited the near real-time agent reporting through SHRAC systems with preventing war between the two countries. SHRAC was the principal COVCOM link between the CIA and General Dmitry Polyakov when the latter actively spied for the United States during the 1970s in Moscow, and later played a critical role in Colonel Kuklinski's successful 1980 exfiltration from Poland. The SHRAC device used by Kuklinski was prepared for him under an OTS project codenamed Discus, and was known at the Warsaw station under the codename Iskra. It was described as follows. The size of a pack of cigarettes, it weighed about 0.5 pounds and had a keyboard and memory. Kuklinski could type in a message at home, place the device in his pocket, and carry it somewhere else. There he could push the transmission button without removing the Iskra from his pocket. The device had a small window through which a single line of text could be read from an outgoing or incoming message. If he transmitted directly into the embassy, an alarm would sound in the Warsaw station. As a rule, Kuklinski was asked to leave a signal in the morning that he would transmit in the night, and an officer would take another Iskra outside to receive the message. The OTS SHRAC systems were an early form of text messaging. In the 1980s, receive-only digital pagers were introduced to the consumer market and later enhanced in the 1990s with the capability to both transmit and receive messages. Once text messaging over cell phones was developed, the use exploded globally, with hundreds of millions of messages being sent daily. Both pagers and cell phones offered new potential for COVCOM and possessed added advantage that the agent did not require dedicated spy gear to communicate. However, these systems were particularly vulnerable to counterintelligence detection if not operated with the disciplined tradecraft needed to maintain their clandestine use. As early as the mid-1960s, the CIA recognized the potential for using satellites for agent communications. The idea was that an agent with a small handset could beam his information to an orbiting satellite, which in turn would relay the data to a receiving site. By combining a satellite send system with his OWVL, the agent could transmit and receive secret intelligence inside his home country without personal contact with a CIA officer. The capability, first deployed in the late 1960s under the code name Bird Book, used low Earth orbit satellites as bent pipe relays for the agent's messages. Unfortunately, field realities limited the operational use of Bird Book. Agents had only a 5 to 7 minute window to shoot the message to the satellite as it arced across the sky. Success also depended on a clear line of sight transmission path, as well as the precise orientation and positioning of the transmit antenna. Hostile counterintelligence services learned of the system and developed means to intercept the signal and triangulate the agent's position using direction-finding techniques. Despite its limitations, Bird Book demonstrated that satellites, signal processing, and component technology could be integrated into a long-range COVCOM system. Over the next 2 decades, new generations of government and commercial satellites increased global coverage, and signal processing improvements made lower power transmissions possible. Advances in electronic components, combined with an understanding of the tradecraft necessary for securely operating a satellite transmitter, addressed many of the problems at the agent's end of satellite COVCOM. A decade before satellite phones were available, OTS, with its industry and government partners, had created a similar covert capability for a small number of highly select CIA agents. While appearing simple in concept, COVCOM systems, including the most sophisticated and technically advanced, are difficult to design and exacting in their use if they are to be employed successfully. Each technological advance, from the telegraph to the internet, added another means of communication, but technical officers had to devise means of assuring security and covertness before the technology could be used in clandestine operations. In the end, whether the secret message is written in the disappearing ink of Caesar's day or encoded in a radio frequency signal transmitted by satellite, covert communication between agent and handler relies on both the technique used and confidence that the exchange cannot be detected or read by anyone except the intended parties. However, as the final decade of the 20th century unfolded, COVCOM, like the other pillars of tradecraft, would be revolutionized by the electronic tidal wave of digital technology, steganography, and the Internet. Chapter 25, Spies and the Age of Information. The electron is the ultimate precision-guided weapon. DCI John Deutsch in Senate testimony, June 25, 1996. In mid-December 1991, the CIA's Soviet East European Division held its annual Christmas party. The mood was especially jubilant, and attendees, including their OTS colleagues, received a campaign-style lapel button depicting the red Soviet hammer and sickle. Beneath the red star were the words, "The party's over." Without media coverage, on December 31, 1991, a small detachment of Red Army soldiers marched to the Kremlin walls and replaced the red hammer and sickle flag of the USSR with the Russian tricolors not seen since the 1917 revolution. For the CIA and OTS, their main adversary had been vanquished. A year later, former DCI James Woolsey stated, "With the end of the Cold War, the great Soviet dragon was slain." Then he wryly noted that in its place, the United States faced a bewildering variety of poisonous snakes that had been let loose in a dark jungle, and it may have been easier to watch the dragon. For CIA officers, 4 transnational intelligence issues had emerged as competitors for intelligence resources, and alongside traditional national targets, such as North Korea, Cuba, Iraq, Iran, China, and Russia. These were terrorist groups and Middle Eastern Islamic extremist cells, proliferation of nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons, criminal and narcotics trafficking cartels, regional instability, particularly in Africa and the Middle East. Less widely recognized at the time was the oncoming technical revolution in intelligence, as the information age